May it please the court, I represent the defendant, counterclaimant, and the appellant, CSAA Insurance Exchange. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I'm here today to refer to three of the cases that we previously cited in our briefs and to argue the following three points. The first one is that the district court erred in denying CSAA summary judgment, given that Rockhill acted in bad faith by failing to afford as much consideration to the rights of its insured as it did and gave to its own rights when defending the insured in a high exposure case under the burning limits pollution liability coverage. Second, that the district court erred by finding that the general liability policy did not apply, even though property damage was caused by a chemical, by giving a broad interpretation to the mold exclusion. Third, that the district court erred in granting Rockhill summary judgment when issues material fact with regards to the conduct of Rockhill were in place. If the court agrees with us on the first issue, that should end your analysis. If you disagree with us on the first issue, you would proceed to issues 2 and 3. As to the first issue, the district court erred by finding that this case was a good faith dispute over whether the commercial general liability coverage applied. CSAA's countercomplaint and its pleadings in the trial court made it very clear that this was not a dispute over coverage, but rather a dispute that Rockhill failed to give at least as much consideration to the rights of its insured as it gave to its own rights. The liability case against Rockhill's insured was strong, with hard damages of $2 to $3 million, and at most Rockhill having only $1 million of liability coverage.
Well, how do you say that they failed in their duty to their insured?
I'm sorry.
How would you say that they failed in their duty to their insured?
By not settling the case when they should have. The law is very
clear. Your first offer of settlement was higher than what remained to be obtained, because it was a burning limits provision.
That is true, but what the odd number signaled was that this was an opportunity to settle the case, that CSAA was willing to take less than the policy limits.
You mean a dollar less?
Whatever was the offer at that point. CSAA at that juncture had not invested $100,000 plus in costs. Rockhill at that point still had well in excess of $900,000 left on its liability coverage. CSAA made it clear that it was interested in pursuing the settlement options, and the undisputed declaration of CSAA Vice President Robert Sturm says that CSA would have accepted less than $1 million in response to its initial settlement demand if they had been offered. And in support of that, he points out that CSA doesn't try subrogation cases. 99% of CSAA's subrogation cases are settled. So the key issue is, was there an opportunity to settle the case? And there was.
Well, you may have put in this declaration, but did you tell Rockhill
No, CSAA was waiting for a response from Rock Hill. When Rock Hill ignored the 30 days time limit for responding to CSAA's settlement demand, then Rock Hill shut down the settlement discussions by offering $101,000, only 5% of the damage exposure in a strong liability case. That shut down the settlement negotiations at that time.
Well, but the policy was only for $1 million.
I'm sorry?
Even under the best set of circumstances, the policy coverage was only $1 million.
Yes.
So $100,000 is at least 10%.
Well, it's insofar as the, yes, as to the available policy limits, it was 10%. As to the amount of the claim, it was 5%. The minimum claim was $2 million with an exposure up to $3 million.
Okay.
When there is a great risk of recovery beyond policy limits, the need to give at least as much consideration to the rights of the insured as the insurer gives it to its own rights requires the insurer to settle a case. Its unwarranted refusal to do so is a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
So what should it have settled the case for and when?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing.
What should it have settled the case for and when?
At that point in time, what Rock Hill should have done was to notify CSAA that it was defending under burning limits coverage, that it had $960,000, whatever the number was, available, and would CSAA consider that in settlement of the claim? CSA would have responded, yes, we will accept that, and the case would have been settled.
Do we know they would have accepted that? Didn't they turn down $700,000 when that was all that was left?
Oh, sure. At many months later, when Rock Hill had burned through $300,000 of its insured's $1 million of coverage, and CSAA had incurred over $100,000 of costs, it was too little too late. In burning limits coverage cases, it is crucial that the carrier not unreasonably delay in responding to settlement opportunities. We didn't get a realistic settlement offer from Rock Hill until the first day of trial. That was an unreasonable delay in this high exposure case that was in bad faith. It failed to give the same merits to the insured's rights as it gave to its own rights.
Were the damages contested at the underlying trial?
Yes, and rejected by the finder of fact. The trial court in San Francisco handed down a 37-page statement of decision, very comprehensive, explaining exactly why the dispute over the damage claims was extremely weak, and pointed out that the evidence was extremely strong. It wasn't what Rock Hill was doing was trying to work out a cheap settlement, and it could do that at no cost to itself because the insured was paying the defense costs. So it continued to try to get a cheap settlement to its advantage while sacrificing the rights of its insured to get a settlement near the amount of its available policy limits. The case that said an unwarranted refusal to settle a case when there is an opportunity to do so is Commonwealth versus Traders and General Insurance Company, cited in our brief. It is just that simple. You are required to settle the case under these circumstances. When Rock Hill received CSAA's $999,999 settlement opportunity, as I said, it should have responded to CSAA, but it also should have notified its insured of the settlement demand, advised the insured that it had 900 and some odd dollars worth of insurance coverage left, and asked the insured if the insured wished to pay the difference. That's required of the carrier. Rock Hill didn't either. It didn't disclose it was defending under burning limits, and it didn't notify its insured of this settlement opportunity when it should have. As I say,
couldn't the insured be aware that the coverage was a so-called burning limits type coverage? I mean, they entered into this contract for the insurance coverage. Wouldn't they be aware of what the nature of the coverage was?
It was at that time, and still is, CSAA's position that there was coverage under both policies. However, it was willing to take what was left of the burning limits policy if it had been offered early on, as it should have been. So it made no difference to CSAA, and that's the reason why it made its settlement demand the way it did. These burning limit policies create an enormous conflict of interest between the insured and the insurer, because the insurer can try to get a cheap settlement at the expense of the defense costs that are paid by its insured. This conflict of interest is so strong that in 8 states, the states have either made burning limits coverage illegal or have restricted how it can be used. The district court held that CSAA had to make a policy limit settlement demand, and it failed to do that, and therefore it could not pursue its policy limit collection. What happened is that the settlement opportunity is the yardstick by which Rock Hill's decisions have to be made, not whether there was a policy limits demand. You know, a public policy is very strong about wanting insurance carriers to settle cases. And clearly, under the case law that we've cited, the opportunity to settle is the standard, and we're citing Reed versus Mercury Insurance Company, which is of course cited in our brief, and the federal court cases included therein, including the Ninth Circuit case of Gibbs v. State Farm. So the undisputed evidence was that the case should have been settled and would have been settled if there had been a responsible answer to the opportunity to settle by Rock Hill. The trial court also said, denied CSAA's motion because it said Rock Hill was relying on the advice of counsel. The evidence was that advice of counsel is not a defense in this case where the insurer fails to give equal consideration to the rights of its insured as it gives to its own rights. The authority for that is set forth in the Judicial Council of California Civil Jury Instructions, called CASI Instructions 2335, and the case is cited in that in that instruction.
Do you have any Nevada law on this subject?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing.
Do you have any Nevada law on this subject?
Nevada law is the same as California law, as I understand it, and Nevada law requires in this case, it requires that while a Nevada law initially applies, then Nevada law says that California had the greatest interest in the case and they would defer to California. But even if there was no Nevada law, it wouldn't make any difference, because there, the important thing is that there was no Nevada law contrary to the California law on this. The Nevada laws don't cover all of the issues that are covered by California, but what normally happens is that there is Nevada defers and follows the California law. So that on the second issue about the broad interpretation of the ambiguous mold exclusion, we've covered that pretty thoroughly in our written briefs. But clearly, under usual interpretations of insurance policies, exclusions are given narrow exclusions, narrow interpretations, and the insuring agreements are given broad interpretations. This wasn't done. And
right, counsel, you're well over your time limits. You're over your time limits right now. So
thank you.
From the other side, and
I will conclude, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, this is Sam. I'm so sorry to butt in really quick, but Judge Eaton, your image is stuck sideways. Could you try rotating your camera really quick? That's much better. Thank you so much.
Okay. Mr. Hussman.
Yes. May it please the court. My name is John Hussman, and I represent Rock Hill Insurance Companies. I will address the issues in this case in the order that the district court did. And the district court was correct in finding, number one, that the mold exclusion eliminates any coverage under the Rock Hill general liability policy, and two, that no viable claim for bad faith exists in this case as a matter of law. The district court was correct because it found that the pollution part of the coverage of the policy applied to the claims by CSAA against Rock Hill's insured Premier. And then it went on to find that the mold exclusion in the general liability coverage part of the policy precluded any coverage. The pollution coverage part applies because it applies to the release of pollutants, and it also applies on its face to a mold pollution condition. On the other hand, the general liability policy contains a mold exclusion, and the terms of that exclusion unquestionably cover damage because of the overspraying of a chemical to prevent mold. Specifically, that exclusion says that there is no coverage at all for property damage or a claim which would not have occurred in whole or in part but for the actual alleged or threatened growth or migration of mold. So, you know, it clearly covers damages and is not limited to just damage caused by mold, which is what CSAA's position has been all along in this case.
Why don't you just get to the bad faith portion of the argument?
Absolutely. I think it's important, though, to point out that these two coverage parts you know, this is exactly what CSAA demanded that its vendors like Premier get. The vendor agreement says that the vendors had to get general liability coverage without, and it could not have eroding limits or burning limits. And then if it did mold work, that vendor also had to get mold and pollution type coverage. And it doesn't say anything about not having burning limits. It's not prohibited. And that's exactly what Premier does. And the point there is that CSA is not a bystander to how this coverage program was put together. It was, in a way, the architect of it. So the fact that it was making demands, it should have known that it was making above limits demands when it tried to make demands to settle this case. To address the bad faith, the district court was correct. There's as a matter of law, there's not bad faith here. And the issue and the reason is important, and CSAA has kind of tried to ignore this, but there's a predicate to any claim for bad faith failure to settle. And that predicate is that there was a settlement demand made within policy limits, and that didn't happen here. The only applicable coverage was the eroding limits pollution coverage, Judge Eaton, as you've noted, and therefore the $999,999 demand was above it. It's important to note that even if the court had held the other way and found that the general liability limit applied and it was really $1 million limit, Rock Hill, there's still no bad faith here because Rock Hill reasonably believed that the eroding pollution coverage applied. If there's a reasonable dispute over coverage, you can't find bad faith there either.
But if we have just $1 million under a burning limits policy, and you know your insured is going to be on the hook for the remainder, and you just continue to defend the case without making much effort to really settle the case, why isn't that, when there's a high likelihood of an adverse, this was a very strong, this was very negligent on Premier's part, there was a high likelihood they were going to lose this case, why isn't that objective bad faith?
Well, because in the hypothetical that you posed, that's not this case. At the time that Premier made its, you know, 999 demand, none of these issues were also clear. Our insured believed and our defense counsel believed that they had followed the standard of care in terms of how they handled the chemical, and we followed that advice all along. We, at every step in this process, Rock Hill actively made settlement moves in accordance with what defense counsel was concluding regarding the reasonable amount of liability and damages in this case. So to say that it was a clear case of liability or that there were hard damages because CSAA prevailed doesn't mean that Premier and its defense counsel and Rock Hill were wrong to ever question their claims. I mean, and that is really, you know, what it means to have a defense to a bad faith case, which is that if you act reasonably, you're not in bad faith. And we acted reasonably at all times. CSAA's essential argument is that because Rock Hill didn't immediately agree with CAA's view of the case, and that, you know, its view of liability and its view of these damages, then it was, that failure to immediately, you know, accede to those other views was bad faith.
Was there a summary judgment motion that was made and denied in advance of that trial?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm not aware of one. There were there were a lot of issues, including expert witness issues, including issues of whether CSAA properly ever tried to remediate the house, whether those efforts were sufficient, whether they, you know, were given time to work, and so forth, you know, before they went and tore the house down. So that I would think that that might have precluded, you know, a summary judgment, those fact issues in the underlying litigation. You know, but the simple fact is that insurers are protected from bad faith if they follow the advice of defense counsel, and they're not forced to settle or win every single case. To hold the other way, that just because CSAA won its subrogation, its underlying subrogation case, would be to turn insurance law on its head. It would create bad faith liability every single time a carrier, takes a case to trial and it turns out worse than anyone expected, anyone on the defense side expected it would. Here, the defense side, Rock Hill, you know, Premier, it's insured, and defense counsel agreed all along on the settlement offers, on strategy, and that CSAA's case was significantly overvalued given that it tore the house down without what we believed, sufficient remediation efforts. And as that liability and damages picture clarified, as, you know, cases mature, Rock Hill eventually offered its remaining policy limit, but CSA turned us down and refused to accept it. CSAA wants this court to ignore the fact that no demand within limits was made, and instead they want to fault Rock Hill for not somehow convincing CSAA that the eroding limits pollution applied. I mean, you know, CSAA has continually argued that, you know, when we got a $999,000 demand, that the response should have been to go to them and say, let's settle. Even though at that point our defense counsel was telling us the case, you know, a reasonable settlement offer would have been $40,000. So, you know, there's no duty at that point. But even if Rock Hill was supposed to divine that CSAA had made a mistake about the limits, there's no indication that had we gone to them that they would have believed us that the pollution limit applied. I mean, they're still arguing that the general liability $1 million limit applies and that the mold exclusion is not applicable. So the idea that, you know, Rock Hill could have gone to CSAA at that point in the case and, had to educate and then convince them what the limits were is, you know, it's pretty absurd to think that they would have believed us or accepted a settlement at that level. And there's no evidence to indicate that in this case that CSAA would have accepted any settlement below the one demand that it did make. Of course they say so now, but there's nothing in the record to indicate that would have been the case. At bottom, CSAA's position really creates sort of a tails we win, heads you lose sort of scenario. On the one hand, CSAA is saying that, you know, both of the coverage parts applies, and it was bad faith not to accept their $999,000 demand. But on the other hand, CSA says that if the eroding limit applies, then Rock Hill should have convinced CSA of that fact and that CSA would have settled. So it's kind of like, you know, there's no win there unless Rock Hill would have immediately agreed at the, you know, a few months into the case that that it was a $1 million case, despite the, you know, analysis and advice of defense counsel. If you'll give me a second. CSAA bar here is to prove that Rock Hill's conduct was unreasonable. Well, its first hurdle is to find a settlement demand within limits, but, and it can't. But even if there was a settlement demand within limits, CSA's burden would be to show that Rock Hill's conduct was unreasonable, but CSA can't really do that. So what they do is create a lower burden for themselves, which is, you know, that that Rock Hill had an obligation to go and educate CSA about the coverage and then convince them to take the lower limit. And they had to do that because they should have, from the outset, agreed with CSA's view of the case. I mean, you know, CSA insists that Rock Hill put its own interest ahead of Premier's. You know, how that just doesn't bear out given the repeated consistent attempts to settle the case, including offer the remaining limits, you know, before trial, immediately before trial. And the record shows that, you know, defense counsel was contesting all of these issues, damages, liability, after careful analysis. So there simply is not a bad faith case here. So in conclusion, Your Honors, the mold exclusion plainly excludes CSA's claims. CSA's attempts to rewrite or circumvent that exclusion have no support in the law. It's just not possible for a bad faith case to exist in here because there was never a demand within the applicable limits. And at minimum, there was a reasonable dispute over those, what the limit was. Bad faith can never be shown here because Rock Hill acted reasonably in relying on the advice of its counsel. And for these reasons, the judgment of the district court should be upheld in its entirety.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Eby, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was, on the first day of trial, I sent an email to defense counsel suggesting that we settle the case by taking the remaining policy limits that Rock Hill had of $700,000, giving their insured a full release and having the two insurance carriers fight it out in a declaratory relief action over whether Rock Hill was responsible for paying the remaining $1.3 million. That was the opportunity that Rock Hill should have seized immediately, saying, we've got to protect our insured, we've gambled and we've lost. But no, they say, well, we'll just let the insured pay the penalty for our bad decisions on gambling this case. There was no advice of counsel in making that decision. Rock Hill made it all on its own. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I'm sorry.
Give me 1 minute or two. I thought I heard one.
I'll give you 1 minute because you were out of your time. You were over your time.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Rock Hill Insurance Companies versus CSCA Insurance Exchange is submitted, and we'll pick up our comments of the day of Rodriguez, the County of Sacramento.